NWP Radio.
You're listening to NWP Radio, a production of the National Writing Project.
NWP.
Welcome, listeners. This is NWP Radio, a production of the National Writing Project. Today is July 23rd, 2020, and today we're talking with the editor and some authors of the new NCTE Principles and Practice book, Writing Can Change Everything, Middle-Level Kids Writing Themselves into the World. I'm your host, Tanya Baker, at the NWP in Berkeley, California. I'm so pleased to welcome to our show today Shelby Witte, Sarah Bonner, Tracy Willis, and Joe Pizzo. Thank you all for being here.
You're welcome.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks. I would love to start our show by doing some introduction, a round of introduction. So I would love it if I just sort of called out each of you and asked you to tell me a little, well, tell me and our listeners a little bit about yourself. Like, what is your teaching history? What are you currently doing in education? And I'm sure everybody would love to know, what might you be doing on a beautiful summer day if you weren't in the studio today talking to us about your book? I'll start with Joe and go around my screen. So Joe, please introduce yourself.
I'm Joe Pizzo. I begin my 47th year in the classroom in November. I love what I do. I love my students, and I tell them that as much as I can. I teach at the Black River Middle School in Chester. I teach at Centenary University, the Edison UN Learning Center. I've also been at Caldwell College. I've been at College of St. Elizabeth, and I've been at Union County College. I love the whole idea of having students and teaching students. It's a thrill to me. If we weren't here chatting, I probably would be on a typical summer afternoon, sitting in front of my computer and creating another spot for my podcast. I do a podcast entitled The Spot of Poetry, and I choose a poet that I'd like to feature. Most recent has been Lamont Carey. Lamont's known for the book, for the poem, I Can't Read. And it's powerful. Lamont has become a personal friend of mine. He spoke with my students at Union County College and even went to bat for a student whose brother reminded her of the young boy in the poem who wants sports more than education. And Lamont offered to have two coaches call the young man to speak with him. So that's probably what I'd be doing.
Oh my goodness. How did I not even know that this existed? But now I do.
Okay.
Wow. Thanks, Joe. Sure. All right, Shelby, you're a superstar, but now you got to follow Joe. I don't know about that.
It's very hard to follow Joe
in
any respect, but I'm Shelby Witte, and I've been a teacher since I was born, if that's possible. I am a middle-level teacher at heart and spent the most part of my public school teaching in middle schools. I currently have the honor of being the school department chair at Oklahoma State University and site director emeritus of the OSU Writing Project. And my work has been and has revolved around middle schoolers and preparing teachers to work with middle school and high school students in English language arts. So Writing Project has been a driving force in my life for more than 20 years. And continues to be just a beacon of light for all of us. So I'm so glad to be here and to talk with you and have the audience join us. And then as far as what I might be doing on a summer day, and if we weren't in the midst of COVID, I would likely be at Lake Algonquin in upstate New York at our family's cabin and throwing a fishing line in the beautiful still water and enjoying that. But nonetheless, I am in almost a quarantine-like situation here in Oklahoma. So hello to everyone.
Hello. Thank you, Shelby. Sarah, you're up.
Tanya, thanks for having me on today.
I am going to be entering, I think it's my 17th year of teaching, when I've always been a middle school teacher and most longest eighth grade language arts teacher. I've taught from urban and suburban areas, but right now I'm currently serving my 12th year at a very rural, small school outside of the Bloomington Normal area in Illinois. In addition to that, I also teach as an adjunct for Illinois State University. And right now I'm trying to finish a dissertation. I'm still close. But it's been really interesting being a data collector and a researcher during the time of COVID, when you think that you're studying teachers and then schools close and teachers can't do what they do best and you're trying to study what they do best. But what actually started off as this research journey has kind of turned into this support group of how do we still keep moving forward and doing great things and supporting ourselves and strengthening our design and understanding of the world. It's been an amazing mm-hmm. thing that's kind of flourished out of such a, you know, time of COVID and everything 2020 has offered us so far. If I wasn't here, I thought about this question as everybody was answering a couple of things. So I'd probably be watching Hamilton for like the sixth time probably now because I just can't get enough of it. Or my 7-year-old and I, we are really big into the Land of Stories right now. Chris Colfer's like set of books. So we would probably be outside reading Into the Land of Stories too. We've been digging that this summer as well.
Nice. Well, welcome, Sarah. I think Thank this you. Is the first time we've met. It's nice to meet
yes.
you.
Yes, nice to meet you as well.
Tracy, hi. You're up.
I'm up. All right. Well, I think that I've been teaching for 16 years. It might be 17. The years are kind of wonky these days. I've taught all over the state of Mississippi. I started in North Mississippi with fourth grade, moved to South Mississippi, sixth grade, Central Mississippi, eighth grade. And then I moved back towards the north to teach ninth grade. And now I'm back where I started in the school district where I started my first year teaching fourth grade at Starkville, Mississippi, North Mississippi, where Mississippi State University is located. Mm-hmm. I also started working with the Ogallala-Gwell Institute for Holocaust Studies and Human Rights in 2016. So I do summer seminars in Mississippi for them in Jackson, Mississippi, where we talk about the correlation between Black codes and Jim Crow laws and anti-Jewish laws and Nuremberg laws. And we make correlations to things that are happening today. And I teach that to teachers. And because we couldn't meet in person this summer, we've been doing a series of virtual book studies. So we did Stamped, Racism, Anti-Racism, and You with Jason Reynolds and Abram Kendi, mm-hmm. That their book. We did that in June. Right now I'm a part of a book study that's reading We Want to Do More Than Survive by Bettina Love mm-hmm. about abolitionist teaching. Mm-hmm. And next month, we'll be reading How to Be an Anti-Racist by Abram Kendi. So we also I work with a teacher who's doing a book club for small humans, fifth graders mostly, who are reading Stamped, mm-hmm. Jason Reynolds, remix edition. Mm-hmm. And we're going to read it with a middle grades group of kids. I don't teach them in the classroom, but I'll be working with them in a book study. So a lot of reading, a lot of writing. If I were not talking to you, I would probably be reading, writing, or sitting in a big black chair with my big orange cat. So that's about it.
Wow. Speaking of things that 2020 have given us, lots to talk about and do. Good for you, Tracy. As always, it's lovely to see you in the writing project space.
Thank you.
Let's talk about this lovely book that you all made. It's so exciting to have in my hands. And later I'll talk about how it feels like being at the writing project to read this book. But Shelby, let's start with you as the editor and think, and you can tell us a little bit about how this book works and how you put it together. So first, this book is part of NCTE's Principles and Practice series. So can you tell listeners a little bit about the series and how this book fits into it?
Sure. So NCTE has a series of books, of course, called The Principles in Practice. And this imprint specifically was designed to offer teachers concrete examples and illustrations of effective classroom practices. So bringing classrooms to life in print for our readership and our members. And they're based on research briefs and policy statements developed by NCTE. So our series editor is Kathy Fleischer, and this particular book is situated in the Writing in Today's Classrooms strand.
Very nice. The book has a lovely three-part structure. Can you explain how you organized it and why you organized it that way?
Sure. So going into recruiting teachers to write and to let us into our into their classrooms and give us a peek of the genius that's happening there, I didn't want to put too much structure on our authors. I wanted to see kind of what emerged and go with that. And so the only structure that we used was the professional knowledge for the teaching of writing policy statement, which really guides and grounds the work of all of us as teachers of writing. And so as the chapters came in, the drafts came in, I started to see themes, particular themes emerge, particular ways of thinking about the power of writing and the purpose of writing. But more importantly, I saw that the chapters started to come around the question of why. What is our why? What is it? Why is it that we do this work with kids? And ultimately, it's the whys that drove the three-part structure of the text. And so the book itself is modeled into three parts: writing that enters the world, writing that moves the world, and writing that heals the world. And in each of those parts, our authors and students in the classrooms show us the power of writing and how writing can do each of those things.
And then as I was reading the book, I noticed that within each of those sections, you have a chapter that's called Micro and Macro View. Can you explain what that means or how that
Sure.
came to be?
So again, part of the beauty in seeing what comes to the book was seeing how some of our authors and their students really were doing writing to change themselves or their small circle of friends, their family, whereas others were doing really powerful writing that were facilitating change in the community and thus the world. And so I wanted to offer through that structuring an example of how starting with a micro can lead to a macro approach, as well as helping teachers see that there's a place for all types of writing and all types of audiences in the work that we do. And so that's how it came to be. And I think it really honors the work that our students, the students and our authors did.
Yeah, I agree. I think I had the sense that you collected the work and saw the themes, but you wanted to hear about, like when you see it, it just feels so perfect. I wanted to hear about how it came to be. And I feel like it does all the things you just said that you wanted it to do. It like gives teachers a real window, other teachers a real window into what the practice looks like in other teachers' classrooms. And it offers opportunities for writing that really stays in the classroom and does the work there, and writing that goes out into the wider world and touches many people. And so what I'd like to do next is take a peek into the book with for listeners so they can get a sense of what they can find there, knowing that this is only the tip of the iceberg, really. There are many more chapters in the book, and they will definitely want to get it after they hear some of the work. But it'd be great for you to hang around and listen, Shelby, and I'd love to bring you back in at the end as a kind of discussant with the editor's view of how these pieces, what you notice when you hear people talk about the work now with some, now that the book is all done and out of your hands.
Great, thanks.
Sarah, I'll start with you if that's okay. You wrote a chapter called The Classroom That Inquiry Built, Student and Purpose-Driven Literacy Learning. It appears in the first section of the book, Writing That Enters the World. And I think it will help orient listeners to our conversation to know that your chapter focuses on what happened when you introduced Genius Hour into your classroom. So maybe we could start by you just telling us how you decided to do that and what was the process of starting and running a Genius Hour in your classroom.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I was really fortunate to build a relationship with Dr. Robin Seglem from Illinois State, who's now my dissertation chair. But she and I had done some inquiry work about 6 years ago. And at that point, I had already been 10 years into teaching, but I was getting complacent and, you know, everything was getting easy. And I knew that if I was getting easy, I wasn't working to keep up with everything. And I knew I needed to keep changing and growing. But I didn't know how to do that. And working with her side by side throughout an inquiry framework in the fall, really successfully, basically transforming my own practice, I was left in December going, well, now what? What do we get to do now? What's next? what do we get to do now? We can't go back to the old stuff. We have to keep moving on.
Nice.
And so, and they're kind of, came out the idea of Genius Hour. You know, we've always kind of, you know, Genius Hour is not a new concept by any means, but we've all often kind of placed it in this, you know, separate realm, you know, whether it might be, you know, maybe extracurricular activities or maybe in a STEAM program or something. But I appreciated the freedom to bring it into a writing classroom, because so much of the writing that's involved in doing something like that, and just to let my students just kind of take hold of their learning was such an amazing feel. Like, I couldn't say no to bringing that into my classroom. For as scary as change can be for teachers, and not knowing, never done anything like that before. Right. But it's been worthwhile ever since.
That's awesome. And you kind of, I feel like you almost anticipated my next question, which is, this book is really about writing classrooms or all the writing that middle school students do. So what is the kind of range of writing that is part of or supports Genius Hour in your classroom?
So I would say that, you know, the range is definitely from agency. You know, I've had students that had to write an email, several, you know, constructing an email, very practical, very, very real world, very necessary needs of writing to activism. A lot of the, you know, inquiry designs that students were a part of, you know, invited them to take some more civic engagement in their world. And so what they were creating, either out of agency or out of activism, also spread, you know, even broke boundaries of traditional writing practices, because they're getting into a lot of multimodal thinking. And they're really being the owners or the authentic producers of their words. You know, they're really building their voice. And, you know, as an eighth grade teacher, I mean, that's what you want for your kids, right? I mean, we want that, but they're getting so formed into their beliefs and kind of really asking these questions and trying to make sense of this crazy world, you know, like letting them be able to actually compose their ideas. And to actually give them a greater audience besides the classroom walls to be heard. And to me, it was such a freeing moment as a writing teacher to be able to let them and see them and empower them to use their words for greater goods.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you've kind of already given some examples like emails, but then this writing is not just for you, but it's out in the world. So can you maybe give us a couple of examples of who the writing went to or where out in the world kids' writing went?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I could just kind of think about some of the more, the projects that kind of stand out from my students that I've had over the years. You know, I had a group of students at a time where we didn't have any type of like, any type of like 3D printing or any type of STEAM program, but they worked collaboratively together to write a proposal and presented that to our school board, and then was able to create and move forward and create that change and have that be a part of our school culture, because we didn't have that, but they saw the need for it. We're in the hub of State Farm. They were able to work with people at State Farm and see what they do at State Farm with this technology, with this idea, and they brought that back to school, and they were able to write and construct for this change. You know, I've had another group of students who, being in a conservative rural community, wanted to make sure that students who identified as LGBTQIA were supported and seen in our community, and they did a series of writings, creations, visual essays that just educated the community, you know, and they were able to build a website. They were able to share their work with the larger community to make sure that those students were seen and heard. So, I mean, you know, things from like tangible actions, like bringing new technologies to our school climate, to taking care of our heart and our social needs as, mm-hmm. as a community as well. The writing in Genius Hour has just been, you know, in so many different directions. And for me as a teacher, it just keeps things exciting because I don't even know what they're thinking of next. Right. It's so great because it's just, they're in charge.
Ah, that's awesome. I was struck when I read your chapter, and I feel like your enthusiasm in describing these things that kids have done and what they might do next really kind of captures this, but I would love for you to unpack it a little bit. Several times in the book, you say, Genius Hour is more than just a project. Mm-hmm. And you refer that to that in terms of like what kids do and thinking about assessment and all of these things. So I wonder if you could just say a little bit more for listeners what that means to you. What's the difference between what you're doing in Genius Hour and just a project?
Sure. When I first started this, you know, years ago, and I said, I don't know what I'm doing. Please give me some forgiveness. We're going to walk through this together. I just want to see how it goes. And they just superseded my expectations by coming up with some really great things. But from there on out, being in a small town, being in the small community, you know, I am the eighth grade language arts teacher. But what became really interesting over time is that as I would maybe coordinate some efforts at our elementary building, I would have fifth or sixth graders come up to me and they say, are you Mrs. Bonner? You know, I know what I'm going to do for my Genius Hour when I get into your room.
Wow.
I want to study robots and I can't
I'm
wait
ready.
To get to your room to study robots. And, you know, in the back of my mind, I'm like, well, yeah, come on, let's study robots. But then I'm thinking, but you can study robots right now. You don't need to wait 3 years to get to your room. So, I mean, one of the things I noticed is it just kind of gained this momentum. It kind of gained this reputation, so to speak. Oh, and the letdown that kids had, like, leaving in March for COVID, like, we were going to get more of, like, youth participatory action research. So we were kind of broadening our, we had plans of building a community teen center. Like, we had done so much work, and then it's hard to coordinate that in online spaces, but you know, I had several students reach out to me like, we had so much work to do, Mrs. Bonner. Why?
That is awesome.
But the ownership the kids felt with mm-hmm. this really comes back to it. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't mean a project. And it the first year that I did it really pushed against my traditional grading practices, which I have now since walked away from, because I will never forget the student who looked at me and said, Mrs. Bonner, you mean to tell me that my passion is only worth 50 points? My passion is only worth 50. And I said, you're totally right. Why should I put points on these things?
And that was
Eastar did more for me as a professional, like really reflecting on my practice than anything I've experienced. And it just keeps growing and building, and it has really been such an amazing thing. I mean, when your kids come to you and they say, you know, Mrs. Bonner, this is the first time I've really been able to think. And I'm like, yes, yeah, that's what we want you to do. Yes.
Right. Well, thank you for the work you're doing in your classroom and your community. And thank you for taking time to write about it. And then to be here with us is so great to get to talk to you about your
work. Yeah, absolutely. Thank you so much.
Tracy, you're up next. Your chapter, That's My Kind of Magic, Writing to Build Community with Middle-Level Kids, appears in a section of this book called Writing That Moves the World. Tell us, how does the work you discuss in this chapter move the world?
I think that in order to move the world, like, we first have to know who we are. And that's where we start. I start with my students, like, what do you believe? And what do those beliefs mean to you? And what do you want? You know? So first we have to get to know ourselves, and we write about who we are as people. I write when they write. We get to know each other that way. And then we start thinking about really what is it that we want from this world that we are in, and how can we change it? How are we affected by what's going on in the world? And that's what I mean when I say that, like, when I ask them all these questions and provide all of these pieces of mentor text for them, it's for them to find the answers, because, like, I don't have any of those answers. And that's kind of like their time to discover who they are and what they want. And then they just write their way out of it or into the world in a way that prepares them to move the world, or allows them really to move the world. My students' writing is in this book, and every time I see it, I'm just like blown away when I see Braham's name and Jada's name and Chloe's name and so many names that aren't there but could be there and will be there sometime in the future, just because they realized there is a power behind their voice. That they matter. Their voices are important in this world. So I think that that's how we move the world, by first recognizing who we are and what we want and how we want to change things.
I want to take a small pause and say to Sarah that she showed a lot of self-control to not just start singing Write My Way Out, but... But good job. I also had the thought. I saw it on your mind. Tracy, your students' poetry is in the book, but so is yours. And, you know, I've seen you speak before, so I could really hear your voice in this chapter. And it was so, it is lovely to see your kids writing, but also I think this practice of writing when kids write is really... it's really obvious in your chapter that your examples and the kids' examples come up against each other in this beautiful way in the chapter that I think is great. I want to say it's really clear, you know, the chapter's about ninth graders. You tell a story about a principal who's like, why do all your kids read books all the time? And then, I mean, the thing I was totally left with that I can't stop thinking about, that even I like, it's a big exclamation point in my set of questions for today, is your kids write so much poetry. They write it for all these different purposes and in all these different ways. Why poetry, Tracy?
Because that's how we think. We don't think in essays, you know? We don't think in complete sentences or full paragraphs. We think in choppy little pieces of, like, here's this idea and this idea and this idea. And they don't all necessarily fit together. So, like, you have to start putting them down or you're going to lose them. And there's this book by Sharon Creech, Love That Dog, where the main character Jack says, you just have to write short sentences. And I think that's how I think. I think in little bitty pieces of thought, and they don't all fit together all at once, but this piece that I thought 2 weeks ago might go with this piece that I thought yesterday, and it fits together. And that's why I have like 20,000 journals, and I'll pick one up and I'll go, oh, that was a really cool thought. I could do this with that, you know? So that's how I think that most of us don't think in big pieces. We think in tiny pieces, and we speak in tiny pieces, and we read that way too. Like when you read something, you take in this part and you kind of think about it, and then you connect it to this next part. And I think that that's what poetry does. It allows us to worry less about punctuation. It allows us to kind of like, I'll tell this really quick story about Bram. The first time Bram turned in a piece of writing, it was completely and totally plagiarized, like just printed out from the internet here, this, and I put my name on it. And so I was like, come here, dude. Hey, what's this about? And he was like, what? And I said, you didn't write this. And he was like, I know, but like, that's what everybody's doing. I was like,
all the cool kids do
it. I was like, okay, but you realize that like you have thoughts and ideas that are important, and these aren't yours. And I know that you can share your thoughts and ideas. So let's try that. And he never stopped. When he realized that he was a writer, that he realized that he had important things to share, forget about it, you know? And he laugh about that piece of poetry that he turned in that was clearly not his. right today, like sometimes I'll go and like I went to visit them before the world closed for business, and I gave him a journal, and he was like, you're back? And I was like, yeah. I went, no. But anyway, I just think that that's why poetry is so important, that it gives students an opportunity to just put their ideas down, and for those ideas to be accepted as important, to know that your ideas matter, your voice matters, that you can change things.
That's
lovely. I hope that answered your question.
Really, it totally, it more than answered my question. It answered my question. It expanded my heart. It provided an example. It did all the things, Tracy. Okay. And I think I want to follow it up with a question that might seem mundane, but you and I both know that in the world of teaching English language arts in the last many, however many years, that poetry might have received short shrift, that there's been this push toward, you know, arguments and informational writing and sort of a strict adherence to some kind of work that some people think does more work in the world. So I'd love to follow up this, like, very, like, you've given all these great reasons why poetry is important, which make my heart sing. And I want to also just ask, how does this poetry writing practice illuminate some principles that NCT has also put forward about writing for kids? Like, to go back to the argument writing, what work is this doing in the world of some principles about writing?
I think that you can find the argument in a poem. You can find the information in a poem. I'm a firm believer in that. I mean, I know what we're supposed to do. I know what, but I also know that I can be moved to agree with you in a poem, probably faster than I would in an essay. But I'll go on and answer your question. But
no, that was a great first answer. I like it.
I really think about the writing and reading are related. That there's no way around it. And when I think about how Mr. Hudson stops me and said, "I don't know what you're doing, but like everywhere I look, there's a ninth grader with a book." And I said, "It's because they recognize that they are writers, mm-hmm. and that the only way to get better is to look at who's doing it well." Mm-hmm. And so readers make the best writers, writers make the best readers, because you're reading to figure out not just what's going on in this piece of text, but also what is this writer doing that is going to make me want to do whatever this writer wants me to do, you know? So just the very principle of writing and reading are related, that conventions in writing, like the way that we worked on conventions was just to pull sentences from award-winning books and say, let's look at what this writer did well. How did this writer use whatever part of speech? How did this writer use punctuation to get their point across? Even though this is a fragment, what does it do for you? You know, so if you can take, you can do that with a poem, you can do that, like there's this poem by Kelly Norman Ellis, Raised by Women. It's filled with gerund phrases. And to me, you see this convention that you've talked about. I will never forget, this was an eighth grade class in Northwest Rankin, and one of my students was just, we were reading that poem, and he raised his hand, and he said, "This poem uses a lot of gerund phrases." And I said, "Well, I'll be doggone." It's like, look at you. Yes, it certainly does. Just so I cannot be convinced that poetry can't do the job, but I'm not like saying that we have to now write all of our arguments in informative text through poetry, but I'm just saying it can be effective. And we can incorporate poetry in more than just the month of April.
Amen. Thank you. I want to round out my conversation with you around the question of assessment and response, because peppered throughout, we see you responding to student work in very, I think, beautiful and humane ways. And in the end of your chapter, you address response and you write, "First, students need to understand that their writing is not broken, that whatever apprehension they are feeling about their words is the way that most writers feel too." I just want to like implant that in the mind of every grown-up who responds to student writers everywhere. If I could make one thing happen, it would be this. I wonder if you could maybe just say a few words from teacher to teacher about what you feel is the role of teacher feedback in the writing classroom, because I think this is a kind of revolutionary view for a lot of people.
Sometimes I've been in meetings like where you'll be like in an ELA planning meeting or a meeting where they're talking about like the writing test. And I will hear teachers say students can't write, and it will like break my heart into a million pieces. And they'll say, "Well, they can't form sentences and they can't do whatever." And I'm just like, they can do all the things, but if it's not relevant to them, you know, like why would they want to, mm-hmm. you know? So, and then when we get them to write something and they show it to us and we tear it apart, why would they want to keep writing? Like if you were just truly going to take my, and okay, so here's the other thing that I feel like, honestly, like why writers write and then they rewrite and they rewrite and they rewrite and then they hand it to an editor and then the editor gives it back and says, rewrite it again. And we go through this huge, amazing process where like if I ever looked at my first draft of this chapter and then looked at this final draft in this book, it would be so different. It was like this birth and growth and develop, and it's an amazing process, right? But that's not what we ask students to do. We ask students to write this thing. Here, let me see it. Let me rip it apart. Here it is, back, given back to you, and with a grade on it. And I'm like, that just seems counterintuitive to what we want to see happen. So, like, why would we do that to kids? Because that's not what real writers do. And as a teacher, I feel like, first of all, don't ask me what you can do to fix it, because it's not broken. And I ask them to read it to me. I'm not going to read it. I want to hear it in your voice. You sit right here. You read it to me. It's just me and you, and I don't know what everybody else is doing, but I better get to doing whatever. So this is our time to look at each other. Like, I'm just listening. I don't have a pen. I'm just like, okay. So first, when you finish reading it, then you tell me what you like about it. You tell me what you don't like about it. I tell you what I liked about it. I tell you what I didn't understand or what I have a question about, not what you can do better. Mm-hmm. So I feel like it's my responsibility to make sure you know you are a writer, you have something to say, your voice matters, I'm just here to listen. And when that kid gets finished reading and talking about their writing, usually if they read their writing aloud, they're like, that's not what I meant to say. I meant to say,
yeah,
just hold on, just finish reading it, and then you can put notes in the side about what you meant to say, but finish reading it. Now, how do you feel about it? Mm. What did you want to say? Can you say it better? Can you say it differently? That's all on you. I had the hardest time breaking through the, just tell me what to do. Just tell me how to fix it. Mm. And it takes probably like a good 3 or 4 weeks before they realize, I am not going to tell you what to do. I am not going to tell you how to fix it.
Liberating and terrifying. Yeah.
So if I could stop being pressured to grade things and having X number of grades in the grade book by the end of the 9 weeks, we could for sure change things. Like, you know, so like when Sarah was talking about not grading, I was just like, I need to know more about this not grading and how I can get away with it. Because that's what, I don't think that we should be grading a student's first draft. Uh-huh. That's crazy talk. And I don't even, again, know if I've answered your question or rambled on. But I think that that's all I have to say about that.
Perfect. You said all the right things, Tracy. Okay. Thank you. I am going to go ahead and move on to Joe, whose chapter, Conveying Sympathy Through Carefully Crafted Words, Rehearsal Meets Reality, appears in the last section of the book, Writing That Heals the World. Joe.
I have to say that I'm overwhelmed by the talent that I'm seated around.
Welcome to my life, Joe. That's how I feel all the time.
This is the best of the best. I'm sitting here and in almost 47 years, I'm still learning every time someone makes a response, and I'm admiring what's going on in the different classrooms. It is so uplifting to hear that positive message. I think as educators, we hear far too often those that can do, those that can't teach. Mm-hmm. And that's not the saying. the saying was done by some little known minor philosopher. I think his name was Aristotle. He said, those that can do, those that understand, teach. That's a big difference.
That's a huge difference. Yeah.
And we need to get that message out more and more to allow lessons like Sarah's creating, like Tracy's creating. And those things need to be praised and elevated. They're finding avenues through which their students can travel. They're finding ways to have those students tie into their own personal voices. That's the key. That's the critical nature of effective teaching, to be a human first before anything else.
Yeah. So thank you, Joe. That was very generous and gets us to your chapter, which I have to say, you certainly didn't know what we would be facing in 2020 when you wrote this chapter. But your chapter is conveying sympathy through carefully crafted words is about just that. And I think I have to start, I mean, we can't talk about your chapter without reflecting on this moment that we're living in right now and all the needs for writing that heals that we're seeing. You must have thought about the students in your classes and what these lessons on conveying sympathy must mean to them right now.
There is a genesis to this entire project, and it started a few years ago. I was at church. I'm an usher and a lector at church, and I had collected the monies and was putting them into the collection bag. In the back of the church, a young lady from college had come with her boyfriend and wanted to introduce him to the pastor, and she collapsed. Passed out, hit the floor. Her mom and dad were there. They gathered around her, and I thought, my God, I'm not a medical person, but I've got to do something. So I ran to the front of the church, found a sink, wet some paper towels, took some dry paper towels, brought them back and said, here, use these to make her comfortable, to at least keep her cool until the help can come. And unfortunately, the young lady, we found out later, had passed away as soon as she hit the floor. She had AFib, was not on meds, and it was immediate. And the parents were devastated. I was so devastated, I went home and I wrote about it. And I posted it up on social media. When I would meet the parents of that young lady, they would always be very grateful and thanking me for my concern. And I thought, all I did was get a couple of paper towels. So I guess we never realize the impact of what we're doing and how impactful that can be, how important it can be to someone. Well, I was doing a lesson in school with Hemingway's short story, and the short story is entitled A Day's Wait. It's about a young man who's sick, wants to go to school. His dad says, no, 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 you have to go upstairs, calls the doctor. Doctor comes, takes his temperature, and he hears the doctor say it's 102.4. Well, the dad wants to deal with the young man by reading to him and comforting him. He says, no, 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 Dad, it's fine. You can go somewhere. So the dad goes out hunting. It's Hemingway. They'll be hunting. Dad comes back, and he tries to read again to the young man from the young man's favorite book, Howard Pyle's Book of Pirates. And the young man interrupts him and says, excuse me, Dad, can I ask you a question? Sure, Shots. Well, what would you like? Can you tell me when, you know, I'm going to die? What? Yeah, could you let me know when I'm going to die? You're not going to die. Where'd you get that idea? Well, the doctor said, I have a really high fever. The dad says, it's 102. He says, no, it's 102.4. People don't die from 102.4. Yes, they do. When we lived in France, The boy said that you can die with a temperature of 40 degrees. I have 102. No shots. That's the difference between Celsius and Fahrenheit. And perspective brings so much to that. And I thought, okay, I want something creative for this story. And I reached back to that incident that I saw in the church. And I said, let's write a comfort note to Schatz. And let's follow the typical, don't use specifics, don't say you did, say it seems. First make a connection, then it seems. You may want to consider. When you go through all of these steps of connecting first, then saying that you think there was a problem, restating the problem, and then don't tell a solution, suggest one. You might wish to consider. It might be helpful if you think about. But I thought, you know, there's not enough to this. Because the most significance that can happen when someone is in pain is for that person in pain to appreciate it so much that they say back to the person giving the comfort, you know what? I really appreciate that. Thank you. And then that person giving the comfort says, I'll tell you what, if I'm ever in need, may I please reach out to you? And that to me makes all the difference in the world, because you now have equalized the roles of both. One person is not the comforter and the other the receiver of the comfort. But you also empower that person who is uncomfortable and uneased to say, gee, maybe I can be helpful too. Maybe I can give back to a place where I've been given. And that to me is the whole motivation behind behaviors that change us, behaviors that put us in a better place.
So some teachers feel nervous when we start to talk about social emotional learning or dealing with feelings, and they feel uncomfortable or unprepared to meet students who might have big feelings or big traumas or big worries. What would you say to them about this work?
I think it begins with the way you approach lessons and the way you see yourself in the classroom. Are you the purveyor of information? Or are you someone who listens to what comes from the mind, but is also emanating from the heart, from the soul? Are you someone who is willing to engage rather than distribute? I don't think you can be an effective teacher unless you do that. There's a whole group of skills that the business world calls soft skills. And a colleague of mine, Dr. Ken Pasek, and I will constantly say, no. That's a misnomer. Those are not soft skills. Those are the power skills.
Those are the power skills, exactly.
Because if you don't have those, you can't make a difference. You're only obeying because you must, not because you choose to be part of the solution.
Joe, before I let you go, I want to ask you about another teaching incident in which one of your students' work went out into the world. So I understand that one of your students wrote a poem that was featured on the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs website on 4th of July. How did that opportunity happen? How did student's work get out there?
We read The Giver. And The Giver, of course, has no color until the end when the colors come. So I said to the students, what a great time to write some poems. Let's write a color poem. You can write about as many colors as you wish. I showed them a published poem about colors and said, now create your own. Find the colors, think about what those colors signify, and then let's develop that into some poetry. So while I gave the students time to write, one of my students is sitting in the back of the room, Michael, and he's shaking his head. Finally, he comes up to me. He says, I got a problem. I said, okay, what's your problem? He said, I'm not feeling it. I just don't get it. I'm not feeling it. I said, well, I'm a poet too. Talk to me. Well, I wrote about red. Okay. I want to write about white. Fine. But I'm not feeling it. Okay, so maybe you want different colors, or whatever you do, don't erase what you've done, because you may end up having to come back to it and then you won't be able to get to it. So make another document. But what do you want to do? He said, I want to write about the flag, red, white, and blue. Okay. So he wrote this poem, came in with it the next day, showed it to me, and I almost fell out of my chair. I said, oh my gosh. He said, well, this is what I felt. Good. I'm glad you wrote what you felt, because this is wonderful. And there were a few very small tweaks with line considerations and whatever. And I said, you know what? I'm going to approach this very carefully. Okay. I may suggest one or two things, but this is all yours. And you take it where you will.
Oh, shoot.
He comes in the next day. He says, my mom read my poem. I said, did she like it? She didn't believe I wrote it. I said, don't feel bad. I showed it to my mom and she said, your student wrote this? I said, yeah, definitely. So what we did is, I said, look, I'm going to try to get this out to as many people as I can and see what I can do. And I reached out to everybody I knew, got, oh, nice job. Oh, tell your student, way to go. But I got a note back from the U.S. Office of Veterans Affairs saying, we love your student's poem. Will you write a blog explaining what the poem is? And then we'd like to feature this on July 4th on our website. And so on the website, when you clicked on the website, there was this poem, the screencast of it, him reciting it. He had an invitation to go down to Houston to read at a reunion of the crew of a ship that was captured during World War II. He was invited, and I was invited also, to go to a local congressman's office. He was presented a flag that had flown in front of the Capitol building. It was amazing, but that's where the reality comes in. And I think you heard that from Tracy, you heard it from Sarah, and when Shelby was looking for things to put into this book, that's exactly the kinds of things that went in. And I tried to carry through this project to its logical conclusion with my co-author, Lauren Zucker, who couldn't be with us today. And Lauren reached out to her students to do something with the shootings in Florida a few years ago.
Right.
Now, I wasn't able to do the follow through with Lauren because my mom became very ill. She had been ill for a while. I was taking care of her. And she came home, went into hospice, and didn't last 4 days. Mm. I lost her on a Friday, got the call at school, rushed home, but it had been way too late. That Saturday morning, I got a call from my cousin. My aunt passed away.
Oh, dear.
So within a 16-hour period, I lost two people I had grown up with and was very close to. Mm-hmm. And that to me is the reason to do these types of activities, because somewhere down the road, they're going to impact someone's life and it's going to be powerful. And maybe you can be a part of that.
Mm. Thank you, Joe. Thanks for sharing that story. We have been talking for almost an hour, amazingly. I could listen to you talk about and bring these stories from your classrooms to life all day. But I am going to wrap up. I'm going to ask you, Shelby, to briefly tell us some things that you noticed as you listened today as the editor who put these works together and in conversation with each other.
Well, thank you. It was reaffirmed to me why we chose these three of the six chapters to share with you what they do and why they do what they do. I think it also illustrates the importance of the teaching of writing in classrooms and what we do relates to what's happening outside of the classroom walls. And I think more than anything, I wanted this book to help teachers, give teachers permission to push outside of the standardized formulaic mandates that they're living under and have proof show for those that make those decisions that this type of writing can and does change the world. But more importantly, it teaches our students to be better writers. And so that really was solidified for me today in hearing this. Why should we put points on passion? Gonna stay with me for a while. We don't think in essays, we think in poetry. That's gonna stick with me. And of course, Joe's heartfelt experiences with loss and how we guide students not only through their own losses, but helping them guide others through their losses as well. Why that's so important. So it's a dream come true to bring this book to life. And hopefully with the learning trackers that are listed at the end of each chapter, this type of book could be something used as an independent study for a teacher wanting to learn and grow in their own craft, or for a PLC, professional learning community in a school, or in a writing project site for summer work.
Yeah, I have to say, I know I said it all to you, that reading this book felt a lot like attending an Invitational Summer Institute, because each teacher kind of put something about their practice out for us for discussion and study and our own growth. And I can really also imagine it having quite a life in writing projects and as a model for teachers sharing their practice. So I want to end by just thanking all of you for putting this book out in the world, and obviously for all the teaching that you do every day that was behind that. So thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for this wonderful opportunity, and thank you to my colleagues for doing the work in the classrooms that you're doing.
Yeah.
Thanks, everybody. It was an honor to be here with you guys.
Yes, thank you.
That was an honor and a pleasure for me as well. Thanks,
you're
everybody.
Listening to NWP Radio, a production of the National Writing Project. NWP. NWP Radio.